Good morning, Connecticut, and to our friends across the Sound. It's Director of Public Affairs, John Voquette. Thanks for tuning in to this week's encore presentation of our award-winning For the People, bringing you the latest information to help address concerns in our communities tied to youth, the economy, public health and safety, aging, education, and the environment. Well, earlier this week, the Center for Family Justice held its annual Speaking of Women luncheon. So we're going to open replaying a chat with the organization's CEO to hear how this vital organization is providing free and confidential trauma-informed services and coordinating care for victims and survivors of domestic violence, sexual violence, human trafficking, and child abuse. Then we're going to replay a segment that focuses on the role that Connecticut's Department of Children and Families is playing in developing and implementing a first-of-its-kind-in-the-nation multi-point response system called the ASSERT treatment model to help more young people and their families cope with and kick opioid addiction. And we'll wrap replaying an interview about the Connecticut State Water Plan, which was developed by the state's Water Plan Council and its chairman, John Bitkoski, to balance the needs of public water supply, economic development, recreation, and environmental health. So we're going to check in with the commissioner to learn why all state residents need to be encouraging their state reps and senators to take up a review of this groundbreaking public initiative when they convene again this fall. We'll be back with these segments and more on the award-winning For the People with me, John Voquette, right after this reminder. Hold tight to your flashlight and brace your soul as you enter the evening realm of Haunted Hale for its 13th year. On Friday and Saturday, September 28th and 29th and October 5th and 6th, spirits will roam the fields of the Nathan Hale Homestead in Coventry as you try to escape from the Headless Horseman. For ages 8 and up, test your bravery with this moderately scary walk through the annual corn maze brimming with frightful Sleepy Hollow themed fun. And for a less frightening experience, you can join an ensemble of eccentric characters at the Barns for more activities. Haunted Hale runs from 7 to 9 p.m. and the last tour leaves at 9. Admission is $10 per person or $30 for a family of four. For hours and more information, visit ctlandmarks.org. All right. Well, we've started on location with our three authors, and then we went to the phone to talk with Dr. Rose. And now we're sort of finishing off with a perfect trinity here because we have a guest in studio, something that's become a little bit more rare here on the award-winning For the People. And it's a great pleasure to welcome back an old friend and really someone who was a fairly regular guest on the program. And we determined that it's been far too long since we talked about the Center for Family Justice. President and CEO of that organization, Deborah Greenwood, is here. Deb spent really 3.5 decades in nonprofit management, and she does strategic planning, fundraising, community mobilization, leadership, program development. But right now, we are going to be talking about the Center for Family Justice, and we want you to put a date on your calendar. That's September 25th because it's the 21st annual Speaking of Women conference in Monroe. We'll be talking about that as well with Deb Greenwood. Deb, good to see you. Thanks for coming, and sorry it's been so long since we talked.
Thanks for having me, John. Appreciate it.
So let's start catching up. What's happening these days? What's the hot item on your plate right now at the Center for Family Justice?
Well, as we became the first Family Justice Center in the state of Connecticut, that was in 2016, we've pretty much tripled the amount of people coming through our doors that are victims of abuse, whether they have been affected by domestic violence, sexual violence, and we, in addition to that, work with a lot of children under the age of 18 years old that have been affected by abuse. So one of the, I guess, second first for us also happened in 2017. That was starting a legal incubator program where victims of abuse that need legal services to represent them in court also became part of our facility at 753 Fairfield Avenue in Bridgeport. And right behind that, we had about 18 months to also be chosen as one of 16 sites in the United States to launch and pilot something called Camp Hope Connecticut, working with children that have been affected by trauma and abuse, whether, again, sexual violence or living in a severe physical abusive home. And we actually had our first season last summer. And we do this in collaboration with the Central Connecticut Coast YMCA using Camp High Rock, which is a sleepaway camp up in the Berkshires. And this summer, actually this Sunday, we send off another group of children. We've doubled the amount of kids we're taking up there this summer. So 48 kids from the greater Bridgeport area will go, no fee attached, but will have a specialized camp that works on the trauma that they've endured while they've been a victim of abuse. So we've been extremely busy, but our focus is working now also in addition with adults, with kids.
Excellent. Well, that is today as we broadcast on Sunday morning. So perhaps folks will be listening to this either on their way to the departure zone for the camp, or they'll be maybe listening to it on their way up to the camp. So that's fabulous. So a couple of the really important statistics that folks need to be aware of is a couple of times a day, year round, 365 days a year, your agency is responding to survivors of sexual assault or their families. And probably about three times a day, you're getting calls to the 24-hour crisis line. So this is really something that keeps the Center for Family Justice and your volunteers and staff on their toes, because, you know, when it adds up, it's a big number. But this is something that that could come at you any moment of any day.
It absolutely could, John. The region that we serve, which primarily is Bridgeport, Easton, Fairfield, Monroe, Stratford, and Trumbull, has logged in 3,661 victims of abuse, all ages, from children, again, to elder abuse. And those are unduplicated numbers. So if you take that and you look at now with the Justice Center having all services under one roof, you could probably multiply that by 3 to 5 times. But on an average across the country, a victim of abuse will go through the system of domestic and sexual violence 7 to 10 times. And why we reduce the number now at the Justice Center is because we have the additional services past the crisis, working with law enforcement that are in our building, having programs like support groups, having a 24/7 hotline where if a client has come through and something has happened after they've talked to one of our counselors, they can still access that hotline at any hour of the day, 365 days a year. And after crisis, now we can take them into self-sufficiency. By that meaning, how can I now move past the crisis? How can I get on my feet? How can I support myself? How can I support myself and my children? How can I find a job? So we have at the Center for Family Justice an empowerment room where individuals will come in to learn how to write a resume, how to find different varieties of jobs, how to move on with their educational support, whether it's getting a GED or starting a career at a community college, or possibly had interruption during their experience where they didn't finish their college degree. So it's been an incredible journey to watch in the last 2 years of how our victims now become survivors.
Mm. And also, people, I think, would be very interested to know that the Center for Family Justice is actually part of the investigative team when these cases come to law enforcement, social services, the judicial system. Tell us the role that the Center for Family Justice plays in the investigations, and how having sort of the foot in the law enforcement judicial end and the foot in the support and the service delivery end really end up combining to provide relief and effective outcomes for the people that you work with.
That is a great question. Again, Wes, we've really expanded in utilizing a lot of nonprofits in our area in Bridgeport that have expertise, whether that is, again, working with law enforcement, a significant partner of a justice center and our agency. When a child will look at a child that has disclosed that they've been abused, whatever that means to them, again, inappropriate touch. Teachers, camp counselors are all mandated reporters. So the journey begins. Law enforcement gets a phone call. DCF can get a phone call. But we are also a National Children's Alliance or Children's Advocacy Center. In addition to working with the adults, we are one of nine agencies that have in our building a very child-friendly suite in the building where our unit, which is really two full-time staff, one that is bilingual and the other who works with law enforcement, also leads this this program, which is called the MDT, a long name for a multi-interdisciplinary team. This effective team is made up of our staff, DCF, Yale's Children's Pediatric Unit, where forensic nurses do the non-invasive examination of a child if it's been sexual assault. Bridgeport Hospital has an area that in the last 2 years they have given us that spot so someone does not have to drive all the way to New Haven where we used to have to go and have, as you can imagine, all of a sudden you found out your child has had the sexual assault and now you've got to figure out how you're going to get all the way to New Haven and you live in the greater Bridgeport area. So we're just adding more stress. We've alleviated that now where we can have that family go right to Bridgeport Hospital. And we're very thankful for that. And with that happening, we take all this information as a team. So from medical to law enforcement to the center, and we put all of our expertise together and explore what's happened to either this little boy or young lady. Again, they're under the age of 18 years old. They can be 5 years old and up to 17. They only have to tell their story one time while it's being videotaped at the center. So these are scheduled. A forensic interviewer, which are individuals that have been trained in a program called Finding Words at the Police Academy in Marion. And I will tell you that the guidance counselors that are now forensic interviewers that also are parts of our constituency have been there for anywhere from 10, 15, 20 years. And you're hearing incredible stories that really can make you extremely angry because it's hard to fathom who would do this to a child. And it's not someone that hides in a bush, not a stranger. It's someone that a child's trusted, whether it's a family member or it's someone that has worked with the child, whether it's in a recreational center. And, of course, a lot that we've read and heard in the media are being affected by children. Many adults suppressed that and didn't report it years ago. So now they're dealing with a lot of trauma as an adult. So we always encourage the family member to bring the child in, at least document it, have the child tell their story. And then what happens after that is now support group for family, a lot of support for that child.
Excellent. We've only got a few minutes left, but and we definitely want to make sure people are aware of the 21st Annual Speaking of Women Conference. It's coming up on September 25th. Folks, mark that date in your calendar. This is a really important event. Obviously, it wouldn't be happening 21 years running if it wasn't both highly attended and extremely valuable for every single person involved. But Deb, if we could really quickly just kind of give us a treetop concept of how you're serving the growing number of folks on the opposite end of the spectrum, those that are victims of elder abuse.
Well, an event like Speaking of Women is our signature event. And we always try to get a speaker that has been relevant to them and they're passionate about this type of work. So what we see is we also work with Jewish Senior Services who are experts in working with elder abuse, and we will do representation in court with them. But the event, like Speaking of Women, the proceeds from that event all go to direct services. Once again, whether no matter what the age of someone, we sometimes forget that our beloved grandparents, and the older I get, I'm in that category of being a grandparent, and I'm very, very blessed to not have abuse in my life. But I will say that there are so many that are terrified to speak up and talk about it. So the proceeds from Speaking of Women will allow someone to get legal representation, have free counseling. Everything we do at the Center for Family Justice is free, and it's also confidential.
So this is an event that you're partnering on with People's United Bank, great friends of ours here at the station. And tell us about it and how folks can get involved and attend.
So if someone is interested in either a sponsorship or to buy a ticket and to come on September 25th, which will be held at the Waterview in Monroe, they can do two things. They can either call us at the center at 203-334-6154 and ask for our development office, which is extension 121. Or they can go on our website, which is www.centerforfamilyjustice.org, and you can sign up online and purchase your ticket.
And tell us about the program. What are people going to be doing and seeing and hearing?
We're very excited this year, our 21st Speaking of Women signature event, for Tamron Hall to be our keynote speaker. And her background will be talking about what happened to her sister, though it was never proven in a court of law. Her sister was murdered, we believe, due to domestic violence. She had been in an abusive relationship. Tamron has written a book about the scenario, but she is a very strong victims advocate regarding domestic violence and why people should talk about it if they know someone needs support to gear them, whether they're in Connecticut, Bridgeport, New York, or anywhere around the country. There is an agency like ours that can provide free and confidential services. We'll also be hearing from a client that had many years ago gone through her own experience. So I always put our client side by side with the keynote, because it's very powerful and very brave of any client to, after the crisis, talk about what happened and now how they became a survivor.
Yeah, but also I have to believe in 21 years, each event that pairs your keynote with a survivor is followed by either people who were right there in the audience or someone that they love contacting the Center for Family Justice, because that testimony kind of kicked the brick loose that was holding up the whole process of healing.
Absolutely, John. We know one in four women will be affected by domestic violence in their lifetime, and we also know one in seven men will also be affected by violence. So we know we'll be talking to someone, many, many people in that audience.
Excellent. The Center for Family Justice provides free and confidential trauma-informed services and coordinates care for victims and survivors of domestic violence, sexual violence, human trafficking, and child abuse across Bridgeport, Easton, Fairfield, Monroe, Stratford, and Trumbull. Their annual 21st annual Speaking of Women event is coming up on September 25th. To learn all about it, all the great work that they do, or most importantly, to take advantage of their services, you can go to centerforfamilyjustice.org. If you're a victim of domestic abuse, you can call them at 203-384-9559, and their sexual assault hotline with experts available 24 hours a day is 203-333-2233. Their CEO is Deb Greenwood. She's been with us to close the program this morning. Deb, thank you so much, and good luck with the event, and
thank you,
continued
John.
Good luck with the center. Well, regular listeners know we have been focusing quite heavily on the opioid crisis that Connecticut and the nation is in the grips of. And we were very, very excited to see about a month ago a release coming out of the Department of Children and Families and Commissioner Joette Katz announcing the launch of a brand new and innovative treatment program for young people who misuse opioids that's now available to help families in towns throughout Connecticut. It's called Assert treatment model, or ATM. And one of the most incredible things, and one of the things we really like to do here on the award-winning For the People, is talk about how Connecticut is such an innovator. And in fact, this program is the first of its kind in the country to be integrated. So we're really pleased to be bringing on a brand new acquaintance at the Connecticut Department of Children and Families. It is the Deputy Commissioner for Operations, Christina Stevens. Christina, thanks for joining us on the program.
Thank you for having me.
So tell me a little bit about the early stages of this. Was the federal grant money that's helping to underwrite or fully underwriting this initiative, was it made available and then DCF went to work looking for the right way to spend the money?
So we had, Connecticut had been awarded what's considered a federal planning grant, and it was called IMPACT, and it was really an opportunity for the Department of Children and Families in collaboration with partners to examine our substance use service array specifically for adolescents and young people. And it was through that process that we identified some gaps that really needed attending to, and some of those gaps were related to access, where access was available, how quickly it was available, to what extent it was available, a significant lack of resources relative to recovery supports for young people, and then this idea of blending an intensive family-based treatment model with evidence-based practices. And so what we learned through that process was we knew how we wanted to fill those gaps, and we knew ways in which we thought we could be even more responsive to young people in need. And so as a result of all of that work, we developed a comprehensive strategic plan for substance use as it relates to adolescents. And then shortly thereafter, the ASSERT grant was awarded. This was a grant opportunity that also came through SAMHSA, the Substance Abuse Mental Health Services Association, through the federal government. And so it really allowed us to say, look, we've already gone through this planning phase. We've identified where the needs are, and we've got some really good ideas about how we think we can meet those needs more effectively. And so we put forth an application that we named the ASSERT grant to get at the kinds of things that were missing in Connecticut that we believed would make a difference for young people.
So for kind of to simplify over, maybe ridiculously simplify things, did Connecticut and you and your partners and your agency invent the ASSERT treatment model, or was this something that had existed in a recovery program somewhere or in an academic setting somewhere that was just waiting for the opportunity to be applied in a hands-on way?
Yeah, so this recipe, if you will, I guess that's the best way to call it, was really a, you know, we had the benefit of, we've got some very robust partners, both in-state and nationally, and that we work with. And so we had a really solid foundation from which to start. But we knew we needed the right cocktail, the right recipe, the right complement of services. So it was really a blending of and building of these different pieces to create a whole that we believed was going to enhance the continuum of services that was available. So for example, we had already made a significant investment in multi-dimensional family therapy, which is a long-standing treatment intervention where Connecticut has seen significant positive outcomes as it relates to youth and families. It's an intensive in-home model. It's evidence-based, very, very strong. What Connecticut was lacking, and many states across the country were, was we did not have a medication-assisted treatment component to that. And so we started working with the model developer for MDFT and said, we want to blend these together. So certainly MAT existed in other places. It does. It's utilized in Connecticut with the adult population. But we hadn't seen it blended in this way with MDFT. And then we added to that, acknowledging the fact that treatment is a really, really important component, but you have to have a strong recovery support system in place to maintain those gains. And so we added then to create this full model to say, you want to see the full complement of supports in order to yield the best possible outcomes.
So once that recipe was in place, Is that when you went out looking for service delivery networks, the Wheeler Clinic for the Meriden-New Britain area, the Community Health Resources Agency for Hartford, Manchester, Connecticut Junior Republic for Danbury, Torrington, Waterbury, Western Connecticut, and the United Community and Family Services for New London, Norwich, Willimantic?
Yes, yes.
So how much time occurred between when you settled on this combining of various proven successful formulas into the recipe and then the training or the orientation that needed to happen at these four service delivery agencies, how much time occurred between when ACERT was settled upon and when these four agencies were ready to launch in late June?
So there were some steps that happened before we got the funding, because again, we had the benefit of the planning grant, which is not insignificant, because that really did allow for us to be even more informed and have done the kind of assessment we needed to do to determine what we were missing and what we needed to add. So during the course of IMPACT, there were a lot of staging efforts, I'd say, that we engaged in. So, you know, we were already, sadly, very much, you know, in the throes of the opioid epidemic, and we began having significant conversations with our partners and model developers around how we're going to make sure that the service system can accommodate young people that are struggling with an opioid issue. And so we even started that process through IMPACT. So I offer that because even though the grant actually was awarded at the end of September in 2017, and then we launched service provision earlier this year, we had already started kind of the preparatory work in advancing our service system around this specific population even beforehand. So we knew, regardless of whether or not this grant came through, and we were eternally grateful that it did, that there were still things we wanted to do to make enhancements to the service system around training, coaching, support, that we were going to do regardless. And then we had this added opportunity and benefit of saying, now we can really kick things up to enhance the service array where we believe it needs to go.
And in the relatively short amount of time that the entire process was occurring from, I would imagine, earlier in 2017 or maybe even late 2016 to the launch in late June of this year, have any other states, county agencies, or even municipal agencies that are engaged with youth opioid addiction already come to the DCF or to Connecticut looking to transplant what we have done here into their environment?
So we are starting to hear, we're starting to get some inquiries about that. So that's, again, it's we're relatively new in this, but that's not unusual for Connecticut. I just have to say that Connecticut, you know, the Department of Children and Families has been innovative on a lot of fronts as it relates to substance use services, whether it's for caregivers with children or adolescents. And so the work, fortunately, and the ability to kind of move these systems in pretty significant ways has yielded some really interesting conversations. We've heard from, you know, not only nationally but internationally. In fact, we recently had a visit from a delegation from South Africa. We had a delegation from New South Wales, where folks are wanting to hear about the work we're doing relative to this space. So I would say yes to that at both the national and international level.
Fantastic. We're going to come back after a quick break. Excuse me, and speak some more with Deputy Commissioner for Operations Christina Stevens of the Connecticut Department of Children and Families. This is about the newly implemented and first of its kind in the nation, ACERT Treatment Modeler, ATM, which provides youths up to age 21 and their families with evidence-based intensive family treatment, medication-assisted treatment, and recovery support services to help them kick the opioid addiction that is plaguing their household. We'll be back. Stick with us. We're going to talk about how, if you know somebody who might be in need of this program, how you might be able to get engaged. Deputy Commissioner, stick with us. We'll be right back. Do you love Connecticut? If you do, there are hundreds of nonprofit agencies, community groups, and grassroots causes that would love to have your support. You can learn about many of them through Love CT. Just go to our radio station website, hit the event guide tab, and click on to Love CT to help the many causes supported by Connoisseur Media. This is Director of Public Affairs, John Voquette. We'll be back to this week's encore presentation of the award-winning For the People right after this news. Now in its 41st year, Operation Fuel is a statewide nonprofit that provides emergency energy assistance year-round to lower-income households in financial crisis. You know that lack of electricity can create serious problems, especially for the elderly, young children and babies, and people who have chronic health problems. Losing electricity means also losing the ability to refrigerate food and medicine, to cook meals, run fans, and have lights and hot water. Operation Fuel wants to help as many households as possible, but the nonprofit needs donations to accomplish this. One of the easiest ways to donate to Operation Fuel is through its Add a Dollar program. Utility customers can add a dollar for Operation Fuel when they pay their utility bills by check or online. Operation Fuel uses 100% of the donations made to the Add a Dollar program for energy assistance. Families and individuals in danger of having their utility services terminated due to financial hardship can also call 211 InfoLine to see if they're eligible for energy assistance. All right. Thanks for sticking with us. We're with Connecticut Department of Children and Families Deputy Commissioner for Operations, Christina Stevens. We're talking about the ATM, the Assert Treatment Model, which is available for youths in Connecticut up to age 21 and their families. And it's providing evidence-based intensive family treatment, medication-assisted treatment, and recovery support services for individuals, actually up to about a little under 100 individuals at a time across the state through four different regional agencies for individuals who are addicted to opioids. Deputy Commissioner, we're hearing a lot on this program for well over a decade, and as the opioid epidemic ramped up and years before it, that the problem was the lack of treatment facilities available for younger people. So I imagine that concern was paramount when you began to hear about the potential to get the resources to put this ASSERT treatment model together.
It was, yes.
So we're talking about roughly 94, 95 families at a time. So is that something that there is an eye on in increasing the numbers if additional funding is available after this initial 12-month period of treatment?
Yes. So what I would say is true with everything that we do is we're constantly engaged in what I would describe as continuous quality improvement and assurances. So we're tracking our utilization and outcomes vigorously at all counts. So what we pay close attention to is understanding need and capacity. And not only in terms of just overall statewide, but are there pockets where the need is greater or maybe less. And so it really is incumbent on us to make sure that we're tracking all of that, that we're understanding where those needs are and how we can pivot and target our resources most appropriately. I'll tell you that in the development of this, we had the benefit of conducting focus groups with young people and parents. And one of the challenges we hear, whether it's about substance use or mental health services, is sometimes people just simply not knowing what's available and what's out there. So we also have to make sure we have a robust social media campaign to make sure that we're taking advantage of every possible opportunity to get the word out about where people that services do exist and where they can find them, because we don't want people to find themselves in a position where they're not seeking services or they get to a point where things are at a critically different place than they would have been had they gotten services up front. So coupled with all of the direct service interventions is the fact that we're constantly making sure that we're getting word out and that we're doing that through a pretty significant social media campaign, and also the fact that we're looking at this from a quality assurance lens to make sure that we're identifying where those needs are and then to determine whether or not the outcomes are what we expected. So we had some ideas, right? This is, we've used the word innovative a couple of times here, and the idea is we're testing this out, that we know these components in and of themselves are valuable and important and yield good outcomes. We're looking at it to see them as a complement working together, whether or not it gets us the desired outcomes we had hoped. We believe it will, but that's one of the things we're going to be paying close attention to.
Mm. The cliched image of intervention typically involves, an adult surrounded by family members and friends. But I don't think we can understate the importance of the family involvement as a critical component of the ASSERT model, right?
Absolutely.
So, yep. Where adults may be much more at risk because they're on their own, let's face it, adults don't have people looking over their shoulder and taking that special care too often. Certainly, statistically, I would say much less often than children do. So let's talk a little bit about the responsibilities and roles that the other family members play in the ASSERT model in order to help affect the ultimate outcome, which is getting the young individual under age 21 off of opioids.
Yeah, so I think, no matter who you talk about, people will talk about the importance of social capital, right? So we, none of us live independently on an island unto ourselves, and certainly that's very true for young people, that they need to know they've got a healthy and safe network of support wrapped around them. So the notion that you would kind of create an intervention that's focused solely on the individual without thinking about how to provide support, guidance, coaching, and interventions for the whole family system would be a missed opportunity. And so it does require and expect intensive family participation, as it should, because these kids aren't living out there on their own, and they shouldn't be. So we're really excited that this acknowledges a family systems approach to this work. You've got to be able to know that you've got that young person has people to lean in on, and that are going to work together with them. So we were very, very deliberate in thinking about an intervention that wove in and expected the level of family participation that this does. We hear from families all the time who were looking for approaches that were going to support not only their son or their daughter, but themselves, because this is an incredibly, to say it's a difficult experience for a family is beyond an understatement. So developing a model that acknowledged and supports that family system was critical.
Very good. In the last few minutes that we have, let's just quickly brief folks on the nuts and bolts of how this works once they've signed on and are accepted into the ASSERT program, because you are currently, the program is up and running and it is working. There are families engaged in it now. There's, I would imagine, still room for some to join in.
Yes.
So tell us quickly about how the treatment is applied.
So you start with a referral, and again, you've been great in acknowledging those providers. So in the Meriden and New Britain area, Wheeler Clinic is the point of contact. In Hartford and Manchester, Community Health Resources is the point of contact. In the Danbury, Torrington, and Waterbury areas, that's the Connecticut Junior Republic. And in New London, Norwich, and Willimantic areas, it's United Community and Family Services. And it starts with the referral. And the treatment providers are immediately currently engaged with the family to go through the intake process, to gather the necessary information, and walk through what this process is going to look like. The multidimensional therapy, that intensive in-home piece that I talked about, along with the medication-assisted treatment, you're talking about a six-month, you know, period of intervention in terms of the MDFT piece. Certainly there's room around a little bit less or a little bit more, depending on the circumstances. And then you've got upwards of a year of recovery management checkups and support, which is really, really important, because we know treatment in and of itself is not the end all of this. And I think, you know, one of the things we constantly try to promote is the earliest of interventions. We don't want to see young people getting into the deep end of the pool. We know that the implications and the impact it has on young people and their families can be incredibly, incredibly awful. And so we're interested in encouraging, promoting, and supporting early intervention as quickly as possible, and then creating that opportunity where there's longer-term supports in place, recognizing that there has to be more beyond treatment. So we're really excited about this opportunity, and we would encourage people to call those providers if they believe that they have a need, and go through the intake process.
And to clarify, folks who make these calls to one of these regional agencies do not have to already be in the DCF system, so to speak. They do not have to be under DCF case management. An individual who discovers that their young child or teen is addicted to or taking opioids can make this step themselves to get qualified, possibly for the ASSERT treatment program, with just the phone call to get the process started.
Thank you, John. I appreciate that, because the answer is absolutely yes. They can go ahead and do that entirely on their own. They do not need to be connected to the Department of Children and Families. And in fact, in a large swath of our service system, we have made a very deliberate decision to remove exclusionary criteria, so that in many of these service types, families can directly refer and not have to come through the door of DCF. We don't want to have to serve as a barrier. We don't want to serve as a road bump. We want to create opportunity where access is readily available and families can go directly into these services.
Okay. And if people call 211 for info line and they just say, we heard about this ASSERT program, will they be able to get the referral to the region and the regional agency that serves their community?
They certainly should, yes.
Fantastic. I want to thank you. Deputy Commissioner for Operations Christina Stevens has been our guest this morning. Thank you, Christina. She is with the Connecticut Department of Children and Families, which have launched a first of its kind in the nation program called ASSERT, combining several evidence-based treatments that are usually stand-alone services into a single integrated program whose goal is to provide a one-stop shop for youths and their families to eliminate barriers to receiving multiple needed services to combat their opioid addiction. Great work on the part of the DCF, Christina, and your team as well for leading point on it. Thank you so much for being part of the program and explaining this process, and best of luck with it. Well, we're welcoming a longtime resource and great friend to the program back this morning. John Bitkoski, we call him Jack, is vice chair of Connecticut's PURA, the Public Utility Regulatory Authority, and chairman of the State Water Planning Council. This year, he's also honored to be president of the National Association of Regulatory Commissioners. And we are here picking up on a conversation that we left off late last year about the new Connecticut water plan. The governor, about 3 weeks ago, signed an executive order directing the state's Water Planning Council to immediately implement the state water plan that was submitted to the General Assembly back in January. This was ordered under Public Act and was developed by the WPC to balance the needs of public water supply, economic development, recreation, and ecological and environmental health. And we talked a lot about this in concept, Jack, as we we spoke the last time, which was basically sending out a message to all the folks in Connecticut that it was a kind of use it or lose it in terms of their opportunity to comment on things that they wanted to see from the water plan. So looking back on that period, tell me a little bit about your level of satisfaction and the diversity of the input that you got thanks to these both these public forums that traveled around the state and this period of public input.
Well, John, the great thing about this was that because of programs like yours, we were ready to get out and to reach people. We had about 36 public events and presentations statewide. We had three regional public information meetings, two that we had with Representative Hampton from Simsbury and Representative Mashinsky from Wallingford and Representative Steinberg from Westport. And then we had a large public hearing last year on it. And it was able to get people from the business community, from citizen-led coalitions, environmental advocacy groups, members of the public, municipal officials, state agencies, legislators, and water suppliers to come and to be part of the process. I mean, as you know, this is the final report is over 600 pages. So we wanted to be sure to give everyone an opportunity to be included in looking at the science, looking at the public engagement of it, the ecological and environmental needs of the public, and most importantly, public health and safety.
Mm-hmm. So the legislative review and approval of the plan did not happen. The initiation of it by executive order did. What does that mean?
That's a great question. What has happened, the last stop in this very long journey was to the state legislators, committees of cognizance, which would be public health, environment, and energy, planning and development, and they were supposed to look at it and ultimately approve it. And there was a big debate over the. There was incorporated in two or three places in the
report, in the 600 pages.
Two or three points. There we mentioned public trust, and was basically regurgitating something that happened in like the early 70s when the initial Environmental Protection Agency for the state was being formed, that public trust was in, when it comes to environment, was people have a right to for water, air, a clean, green environment. And that's really what was in that particular statute. And what we did is we cited that in our report to make sure that people were aware of it. And that created a great deal of debate in terms of what it actually is. And you can ask six different lawyers their interpretation, and you get six different answers.
Mm. From your perspective, as you kind of walk along this razor's edge pinnacle between those who would advocate on behalf of the public trust and the regulated water companies that operate in Connecticut under PURA, what were some of the things that you were hearing from the water companies?
I think what was the issue was really when it comes to the oversight of the water supply, who has the authority to say what companies can do with their water supply, and who, if you had this public trust, would it mean that when a company wanted to, for example, open a bottling plant or something like that, who would have the oversight? And water, as a utility, is the most heavily regulated water utility we have. It's regulated by Public Utility Regulatory Authority. It's regulated by the Department of Public Health, Department of Energy and Environmental Protection. So these issues that were coming forth are issues I, quite frankly, I'm very optimistic with the governor's executive order, because he's telling us to carry on with the implementation of the program. But to submit the report, to say we're not going to change the report, we're going to submit the same report to the legislature next year. And hopefully by that time, we'll be able to diffuse some of the debate. Everybody hats off to all the people that are part of this process, the environmental advocates, the Save Our Water people, the good stewards for the environment. But the water companies are also good stewards for the environment. So I just think we have a little bit of a misinterpretation to debate in this, but I'm optimistic we'll reach consensus by the end of the year.
Well, I think it's important to assert here, too, that while the ultimate cost falls on the ratepayers. We have heard on this program before from several sources that, you know, the water companies, which are so heavily regulated by this trinity of DEEP, DPH, PURA, and some federal agencies too, right? I mean, there's some federal oversight on water as well. So it goes far beyond just what happens within the confines of the state of Connecticut when it comes to water companies operating in Connecticut. But these companies are responsible for, and it appears are motivated to ensure that their mechanics and infrastructure and sites are well protected and you know, to the degree that it can be, you know, on the cutting edge of being you know, operational from a mechanical infrastructure standpoint, state of the art.
John, you're absolutely right. I mean, and I'm glad you pointed that out, because not only are they heavily regulated by the state, it's the, you have federal EPA guidelines that need to be adhered to, and you know, as I said, you know, the health and safety of our water supply is of utmost importance to everyone. That's why we're constantly upgrading filtration plants. We're upgrading our infrastructure system. We're looking at ways to make sure that people continue to have a free flow of potable water within the state of Connecticut. And it's used, as you said earlier in your introduction. I mean, it's the only utility we ingest. We can't live without it. It's used for economic development. It's used for recreational. It's used for environmental. So the list goes on and on and on. But that being said, we need to, you know, make sure that we don't get just haphazard about the oversight of the water supply.
Mm. Going back to the legislative approval, does the lack of that in the interim between when the executive order was signed and the eventual looking at it, that, I mean, they have to take this up next session, right? They don't have an option to just let it go by executive action, right?
No, they have to take it. I mean, it would be much nicer if we had had this approval going into the next several months. But yes, it's got to be taken up again. And I think that, you know, this will give us an opportunity to hopefully get by some of the questions people have about this whole public trust issue, so that any type of apprehensions people may have about it, we can address. We're all people that really, for the most part, I think everybody really wants this water plan to be passed, and it'd be one, the first one in New England, it'd be one about 20 in the United States, and you know, Connecticut's very much at the forefront, as you indicated in my intro, that I'm very involved in national regulatory work, and Connecticut has been very far ahead of some of the other states in terms of what we've done in terms of protecting and maintaining our water supply.
Yeah, I imagine when you're interacting with your national colleagues on the National Association of Regulatory Commissioners, more than a few have said, hey, the minute that 600-page document comes out, you send me a PDF because our state wants to look at that.
You're absolutely right, John. You're absolutely right. That's happened to me more than once. People want a copy of it because they're trying to do the same thing in their respective states.
Great. Well, in the last 3 or 4 minutes that we have with you, Commissioner Bukowski, let's talk about going forward with or without legislative approval. This is not just something that the executive order was signed and boom, it goes onto the shelf. There is a directive to either continue working with or reform some sort of advisory group, right?
Yeah, absolutely. The Water Plans Council Advice Group is a statutory group, basically made up of stakeholders that are involved in the water industry. And they're going to be very much, as a matter of fact, they're going to be part of the implementation committee. We're going to be really leaning heavily on them in terms of with their education and their insight and their experience to help us make this plan a reality. So we want to make sure address some of the issues people have. We want to make sure this is a very inclusive group. So, and it's set up statutorily by who should be in it. And so I'm very optimistic. We have a great cross-section of people throughout the state of Connecticut that are part of that group.
Do obviously, citizens can play a very active role beginning the minute they hear this program in getting on their email, getting on their phone, looking up their state senators and state representatives to implore them to expedite taking up the review of the state water plan as soon as the next session convenes. But can the same citizens do anything in terms of supporting this this implementation council?
Yes, absolutely. And I always like to get our website, www.ct.gov/water. And that's www.ct.gov/water, so people can see when our meetings are, when our deadlines are. Our meetings are always open to the public. We have public comment. They can write letters, they can send emails, and they can keep their respective legislators and senators apprised of the process and support the plan.
So there will still be public comment on the implementation now that the executive order is signed?
Correct. We are right. Our meetings are always anything people would like to say at our meetings publicly. We make them part of the transcript and part of the record.
Mm-hmm. Very good. In the last minute or so that we have with you, Jack, you know, we're coming into a wicked hot week as we tape this on the first weekend of July. How are we looking? Do we have a statewide restriction now going on water?
No, thank goodness. Thank goodness, no. And so far, we're okay, but we're constantly monitoring our water supply between the respective agencies, health, environment, and ours, to make sure that we have an adequate water supply. But just like with our electricity, with our water, we ask people, you know, don't be washing your car 3 times a week when it gets like this, because if we have a hot spell like this, you and I have both lived through the drought situation, so we can't take the water for granted. So we just have to be very conscious of how we utilize our water.
Very good. Well, as always, Jack, you know, going back to your days as a state rep, you've been a great resource to this program and a huge resource to the state of Connecticut, doing us proud by being elevated to the position of president of the National Association of Regulatory Commissioners. In fact, all the others in the United States this year are looking to you for leadership, and they're getting it as vice chair of PURA, Connecticut's public utility regulatory body, and chairman of the State Water Planning Council, wearing a lot of hats, but really appears that there's great leadership going on. So we appreciate all that you're doing, and thank you for this touch base on this new Connecticut water plan, which is now in place. Folks, write and call and email your legislators. Tell them first thing the next session they need to review the state water plan. You've been listening to our award-winning public affairs program, For the People. The opinions expressed on this broadcast represent those of our guests and host. If you have a suggestion for a guest, an issue, or a PSA relevant to the audience and communities we serve, you must make a request for airtime in writing to me via email at john.voket, that's john.voket, at connoisseurct.com. We do not accept pitches or requests for coverage by phone. Remember, no part of this program may be copied, disseminated, or rebroadcast without permission of Connoisseur Media. Our public file, reflecting the full scope of our station's responsiveness to critical issues in the communities we serve, can be reviewed upon request during normal business hours at 440 Wheeler's Farms Road in Milford or on our station website. Our theme music is by Rick Miller and Scotts, with original music by Noel Viette. I'm Director of Public Affairs, John Voket. Join us again at this time next week for more conversation and important information on the award-winning For the People. Don't forget, you can listen to this and other For the People podcasts anytime on iTunes or under the podcast tab on our station's website. Until this time next week, thanks for listening.